What We Spend is a new podcast that explores something we almost never talk about. Every week, you'll hear a different guest share everything they spend their money on. What We Spend is available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So they got that tropical area in the Gulf that should lead to a lot of rain tomorrow, this evening, tomorrow, and primarily Friday, as I understand it. Then it clears out, which if that happens, then everything will be dry enough on the weekend to cut the grass. Notice my big frame of reference, cut the grass, because that's the big duty that we all have during the summertime. And once it gets out of hand, it's a mess. Justin Buechler joins us, associate professor of political science at Case Western Reserve University. Talk about immigration. How you doing, Professor? Good morning.
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. What does this new poll show?
So we've got a bunch going on here. The sort of trouble with asking about immigration is the same with asking about a lot of issues, which is that most people don't have stable preferences about policy. So there's sort of a calibration issue. And one way to think about it is you're looking for something and there's somebody telling you warmer, warmer, colder, colder. And what's happened is we sort of swung between extremes. So if you think about the Biden administration, we had not a lot of border controls. So we had a lot of illegal immigration, and we've swung to the other extreme. And if you look at what's going on in this Gallup poll here, we've seen preferences move because we've gone from very few immigration restrictions to very restrictive policies. So if you look, for example, at what's going on, even on the Republican side here, we've gone from Republicans thinking that in 2024, we had 88% of Republicans saying that immigration should be decreased. And that's gone down to 48%. And the proportion saying that it should be kept about the same has gone up from about 11% to 36%. So what's going on is this calibration issue where you swing from one extreme where we really have no border controls to very restrictive policies, and public opinion is responding because most people don't really have stable positions on policy. What's going on is people sort of saw no border controls, and then we swing over to much more restrictive policy, and public opinion adjusts. So that's basically what's going on here, and we see a bunch of variations of that.
Did this poll distinguish between immigration? Because I think when you say immigration, it's a pretty complicated process as it stands now, as opposed to illegal crossings. And again, if you want to go to immigration, well, we're all immigrants if you're not Native American, because we all came here from somewhere else, right? So did the poll distinguish between that?
Yeah, there are a bunch of variations here. So there are some questions on specific policies and changes in support. So, for example, we've got a bunch here on specific proposals like what we should do with illegal immigrants versus immigrants who are brought here as children. And so, for example, we have the question of what to do with people who are brought here as children and whether or not they should be given a pathway to citizenship versus border patrol. So we've got a bunch of variation here because, like you said, this is a complicated issue. And there's a lot more support for people who are brought here illegally as children being given sort of a pathway to legalization rather than people who cross the border illegally. And that's a big difference. So, for example, we see in 2025, I'm looking at 85% in 2025 saying that people who are brought here illegally as children should be given a pathway to legalization versus deporting illegal immigrants. There's much higher level of support for that. But yeah, this is a complicated issue.
Did this poll address birthright citizenship?
Now I have to, let me do a quick search here.
Well, because that's another portion of it, right?
Yeah.
I'll read some text while you do that, then we'll take a break and we'll come back. Some of the texts that are going in, Tommy, I think the border's 1,000 times better than it was under the previous administration. That being said, with all the negative publicity crackdown on immigration getting from the press, it can't help but sway the, I guess, the position of the country, but blame it on the press, I guess. As far as immigration, just keep the ones we have unless they have criminality with them. Stop them from coming in illegally and coming to our country the right way. To me, it would be too involved to get rid of compliant immigrants, but definitely get rid of the bad ones. 100% against illegal immigration. Respect the laws of my country, period. I was wondering the other day, what was more annoying? When somebody ends a sentence with period, close discussion, end of discussion, or... Anyway, somebody says, how about we enforce the laws on immigration as written? Somebody else said, grew up in a construction family, 70s, 80s. No one is in construction anymore because of illegal immigrants, made the wage absolutely unlivable. So that brings the question of who's making the money there? Because is if they were to not pay illegal immigrants and pay a wage, a living wage to people that were in this country, then that means either the prices are going to go up or the builders are going to have to take less profit in the economic model, I think. 620 traffic now, WWL. It is 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Justin Buechler, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University about immigration. Some texts coming in, we're not immigrants, we were born in America. Well, unless you're Native American, your people came here from somewhere else. When convenient truth is America is addicted to cheap wages by immigrants as long as it doesn't affect them, I think that's kind of true. We're talking about a new survey out about how Americans have changed their mind on immigration. Professor, when it comes to people like, there was a woman in New Orleans, a woman had overstayed her visa, 47 years old, originally from Iran. It's a complicated case when it comes to immigration and visas and this and that and the other thing. She was rounded up, never been in a hint of trouble at all, a good citizen, supports the community, whatever it is. The Republicans got together, the Republican delegation, and got her released from ICE custody. Is that the kind of thing that can kind of turn Americans around on this, where it's like, well, wait a minute now, just because somebody's here illegally and maybe didn't technically follow what they're supposed to do, we don't need to round them up?
Well, that's a, yeah, I mean, that's a kind of an example because there are a lot of different kinds of cases. The clear cases that most Americans do want deported are the people who cross the border illegally and then committed crimes. There's pretty much universal support on that. Then you get into more complicated cases. So if somebody crossed the border legally but then committed crimes, then you'll get higher levels of support. But if somebody crossed the border legally, that means you've got a different position and then didn't commit crimes. Well, overstaying a visa, what happens if somebody overstays a visa? That's technically a violation of immigration law. But if that person also didn't commit crimes, then a lot of Americans are going to have more sympathy for that. And so you look at the range of different violations that can occur, and there are going to be some people who are just hard line on immigration and say that if there are any violations whatsoever, deport that person. But given the range of potential violations, some people are going to be more sympathetic. And you can get a lot of sympathy among Americans for somebody who crossed the border legally and didn't commit any other violations.
Is it, as you say that, I'm thinking maybe it's more about crime because honestly, if they got violent criminals, I'd just soon see them deported if they were born here as opposed to people across the border and behave themselves. Does it come down to bad actors? Is that ultimately what people are feeling and thinking, whether they came here legally or not?
Well, that's really where you will have the highest level of support for deportation. For American citizens, we don't deport American citizens.
No, I know that. I'm just saying that emotionally, though.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty clearly where you will have the highest level of support for deportation. And as you move away from that category, you will have lower levels of support. And that's what makes this complicated is there's so many variations of different kinds of cases for immigration. And as you move towards more sympathetic cases, there will be higher levels of support for letting people stay. As you move towards more unsympathetic cases, there will be lower levels of support. And what's happened is we've moved from sort of a lack of enforcement on immigration law to levels of enforcement that Americans are kind of uncomfortable with. And that's swinging between the extremes.
I get a text that goes like, you know, maybe 35 lines. I'm not going to read it all, but basically they're saying they don't know what's going on with immigration. Does the United States really have a handle on the immigration situation?
We've gotten better control on the border. That's pretty clearly true. But we also have issues with ICE that have made a lot of people very uncomfortable. So it is possible to get more control on the border, but the question is what Americans think about some of ICE's tactics, and there are a lot of Americans who are uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, it sounds good till you see it. Then all of a sudden it's like, well, maybe not. Thank you, sir. Justin Buechler, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. We come back. We're talking to Patrick Penfield, Professor of Supply Chain Practice at Syracuse University. A new consumer price report came out. Inflation rose at the highest rate since February. Some will tell you inflation's down. Some will tell you it's up. Some will tell you prices are down. Some will tell you prices are up. We'll see when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. 6:44, 16 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, going to rain tonight, tomorrow, and Friday. But then for the weekend, it should be over as far as that tropical system goes. That's what they're saying now, so we'll be aware of that and keep you apprised of everything you need to know. Patrick Penfield joins us now, Professor of Supply Chain Practice at Syracuse University. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good, Tommy. How are you doing?
I'm good. You had nothing to do with this at all, but I thought I'd ask you. Today is National World Snake Day. When it comes to snakes, are you snake friendly? Would you allow them in your house or not?
Oh yeah, I love snakes. Snakes
really? Really?
Yeah, no worries with snakes.
No kidding.
As a kid, I had some pet snakes.
Really? What kind?
Yeah. I just see garden snakes. You know, nothing major. You know, just stuff we caught around the house. You know.
My family, but you got to realize my family is different. They kept giving me cobras for pets. Cobras and rattlesnakes. That's what they kept giving me. Tell me about what's going on with Consumer Price Index, a price report. I don't know. I don't understand what all these things are.
Yeah. So Consumer Price Index is, it's just a report. Basically, it's where the government has a bunch of economists that kind of analyze what's going on with pricing in the United States. And unfortunately, prices went up in June. And so... this is unfortunately, we're starting to see things start to tick up. And I think we talked about this last time, you know, about we're starting to see the tariff effect.
So I was listening to somebody yesterday. I don't know if it was conservative radio. I don't know if it was President Trump. I don't know who it was because I flip all over the place, you know, try to catch a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Talking about going down a checklist about this, that, the other thing, inflation down, prices down. And I thought that sounded good to say, but that's not necessarily what I see in the grocery store. Is there anything to back that, or is that just political spin?
I think it's political spin. So, you know, year over year, you know, we're looking at about a 2.7% increase over prices from last year. So, yeah, absolutely, prices have gone up. I think, you know, in their defense, you know, we haven't really seen it really jump up or ramp up the way we thought it was going to because, the tariff impact. So, you know, it's not bad. I mean, the Federal Reserve would prefer to be at about 2%. That's about normal. But, yeah, it's about 2.7%. And, again, it's starting to climb up.
But when it comes to tariffs, I don't know how you would say tariffs raise prices or not, because I don't know if they're on or not. I don't know what goods they're on at what time and what goods are in stock that have been tariffed or haven't been tariffed or who's eating the tariff. I do know somebody's paying the tariffs because they said that it brought $100 billion into the Treasury. So somebody had to pay that, right?
Absolutely, Tommy. So I work with a lot of companies locally. And so we had we've had some training sessions the past couple months. And it's interesting that, you know, the companies are smart and they try to get around the tariffs. And so I think one of the reasons why you don't see it right now is right before April 2nd, when with the President Trump's Liberation Day with tariffs, a lot of companies brought inventory in. I mean, they worked really hard to do that, and so they had inventory, and then another thing that companies were doing is that they started to resource to other countries with lower tariffs. And then lastly, you know, some of them are looking at tariff reengineering, where they can kind of bring in stuff that's changed, that's at a different tariff rate than their original tariff rate. Mm-hmm. So the companies have been very clever. And then another thing is they actually have been negotiating with countries, suppliers in countries, to take some of the, you know, the tariff, you know, hit. And so that's kind of been buffering, you know, the overall tariff impact. But eventually, you know, these companies are going to run out of inventory. The prices, you know, tariffs keep going up. So, you know, eventually the suppliers are going to say, look, we can't, you know, bear the burden of this. So it's going to come to an end soon, but we just haven't seen it yet.
So they say it brought $100 billion into the Treasury. I think the Treasury Secretary said that, if I'm remembering correctly. Where'd that $100 billion come from?
Tommy, you're absolutely correct. So that came from the people that actually paid when it came into the country. So the custom border folks, once, you know, stuff comes into, you know, to the ports and you know, here in the United States, what they'll do is they'll charge whoever picks up the stuff, and they'll say, okay, this is the additional charge for the tariffs. So yeah, the person that orders the materials that comes into the country, they pay that tariff.
All right, let me take a break. We come back. I want you to kind of walk me through what happens here, and I don't know if you want to make it from a wardrobe standpoint or what is produced with a lot of imported goods that are subject to tariffs, Professor. You got an item for me or items?
Sure.
Like what?
Yeah, we could talk. We'll do apparel.
All right, let's do apparel. All right. So we'll talk. We'll take the anatomy of tariffs as they relate to apparel from the time either the finished product or the raw material leaves the country upon which the tariff has been placed and gets on the ship, and what happens after it gets to the dock, because I think a lot of people know of this. They don't really know about it. Patrick Penfield's our guest, professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse University. If you have any questions or comments about tariffs, you can text them into 504-260-1870. It's World Snake Day. I'm getting texts about snakes. You can text that in as well. Same number, 504-260-1870. Don't ever text and drive, because if you do, Tim's going to come get you. 6:50, 10 till 7. Traffic now, WWO. 6:56, 4 till 7. Look at Tim Zimmer there on top of it on National World Snake Day. We're talking to Patrick Penfield, professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse University, about tariffs. And we thought we'd look at the anatomy of tariffs from the apparel standpoint. So take me through it, professor. When, I don't know, you'll pick a country and pick a product and then take us through it that way?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's say, Tommy, I'm a concert T-shirt producer. Okay. And so let's say maybe I sell to the promoters like, you know, Styx and Foreigner, Def Leppard, Kiss. Some of your listeners might remember those bands. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're touring the country. So I go ahead and I find a supplier in China, and they agree to make, you know, my Kiss T-shirts and my Def Leppard, my Styx. And they say, well, you know, we'll charge you $10 per T-shirt. And I'm like, great. That's, you know, the best price, and I'm going to get them from China. So I go ahead and I place an order, and let's say I order just one, just for, you know, simple example purposes. So it comes in, you know, to the ports, and then I go to pick it up. I'm very excited. It's a Kiss T-shirt, and, I'm thinking, oh, it'll be $10. Well, as soon as I go to pick it up, the customs is going to give me a bill for $3. And they're going to say, hey, look, you got to pay this $3 or you're not going to get this T-shirt. Mm-hmm. So now instead
that's presuming it'd be a 30% tariff, right?
30% tariff. Yeah, yeah. So now I'm paying $13.
Right.
And I was thinking, oh, I'm going to make, you know, I'm going to sell these for $15. And now I'm going to lose $3 worth of profit because I got hit with this custom charge. So that's what's going on, Tommy, is when you bring something in from the country, the supplier's not going to charge you, but the custom border agents are. And so if President Trump says, you know, I'm not very happy with China, I'm going to now enact 100% tariff. So now my $10 T-shirt that I brought in is going to cost me $20, and now I'm not going to make any profit. And so this is kind of what's going on with the small companies. You know, they're really struggling with, you know, trying to make money. And the big issue, Tommy, is certainty, right? If President Trump said, here are the tariffs, this is what they're going to be, then I think companies could kind of deal with that. And they could say, okay, yeah, we're, you know, we can figure it out. We can, you know, make sure that we're charging the right amount. But if it changes constantly, then it's very difficult to make money.
So then the question is, okay, on this Styx T-shirt, why don't I have it made in the United States?
Because it costs twice as much.
Okay.
So it's going to cost you $20 versus $10. And you know, like, oh, you know, my customers may not want to pay that much. They might say, you know, we're not going to pay that much. And most of your apparel is made, you know, in Asia, you know, Bangladesh, China. And that's just because it's all labor intensive. And, you know, the folks there, when they're making T-shirts and socks and underwear, you know, they're making, you know, less than a dollar, let's say, than versus what, you know, what we pay here from a minimum wage standpoint. That's stuff that we don't want to, you know, to manufacture or produce here in the United States. It's just not cost effective, and it's not worthwhile for companies to do.
So if you want to bring manufacturing back to the United States, you can be for that, but keep in mind that T-shirts could be $20, not $10.
Or exactly.
Going to cost $20 to make.
Yeah, Tommy, you're absolutely correct. And I'm a big proponent of manufacturing, but let's manufacture, you know, the high quality, high worth items like semiconductors and airplanes and cars. And President Trump's right from that vantage point. We have to manufacture. We just got to manufacture the right stuff.
Got you. Thank you. Appreciate your time. Patrick Penfield, professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse University. Might have a name storm in the Gulf. We'll talk about insurance with Tim Temple, Louisiana Insurance Commissioner, when we come back. 7:15, got that area of disturbed weather. I guess is what we're calling it, right? Area of disturbed weather for now. Maybe it could become a named storm. If it would, it would be Dexter in the Gulf. They're saying primarily will cause some rain for us tonight, tomorrow, and Friday. I guess there's always a chance for street flooding, but actually there's a chance for street flooding every summer day, if you look at it. Tim Temple joins us now, Louisiana Insurance Commissioner. How you doing, Tim?
Hey, good morning, Tommy. And, yeah, I think it's still at the tropical disturbance level. And, you know, I think, you know, I just want to remind your listeners that, you know, we know if you know you live in an area that's prone to flooding, you know, let's start thinking now and prepping now, moving property to higher ground, vehicles. You know, I just heard that, you know, they've opened up some of the sandbag stations in the New Orleans area. So, you know, if you know you live in an area that's prone to flood, let's go ahead and start prepping for that. Do what you need to do, because the weather reports we've seen, it could go all the way through Sunday, and, you know, anywhere from 6 to 8 inches in concentrated areas. So this could be a big water event.
Tim, I'm an honest guy, and I'm going to go to confession here. One time I went to get sandbags from Plaquemines Parish because I wasn't worried about flooding, but I had holes in the yard that I needed to fill, and I actually tore the cartilage in my knee moving the sandbag, which led to a knee replacement. So there's no good that can come out of misusing materials.
Yep. Let that be a lesson. You try and cheat, you're going to pay.
That's the point I'm making, Tim Temple. So
the other thing, too, yeah. Tommy, real quick, is, you know, as we talk about this, you know, one thing I want, again, to remind your listeners that, you know, this doesn't appear right now to be a wind event. So when we're talking about coverage and your homeowner's policy, you know, if you flood, obviously that's not covered by your homeowners. A flood policy would be if the water is rising from below. If a tree were in this event were to fall on your home and cause roof damage and then water leaks into your home as a result of that, then your homeowner's policy would cover the damage to your roof and the damage to your interior. So that's kind of the bigger picture that, you know, you've heard me say before, and we're trying to message be insurance ready. And by that, I mean, you know, I think it's best for people to understand how their insurance policy works, what it covers and what it does not cover. And so, you know, I'm encouraging people, read your policy, understand it to the best of your ability. If there's things that you don't understand, pick up the phone or go visit your agent. You know, whether you're with an independent agent or with a direct writer, sit down, talk to your agent and have them explain exactly what's covered and what's not. Because I think if people understand how insurance works, they will have a better claims result, you know, when that claim occurs.
And as we approach the 20th anniversary of Katrina, if I remember properly, one of the big concerns was flood insurance and homeowners insurance fighting it out over which came first, the wind damage or the flood, right? Because if the roof had come off because of the wind, well, then the flood doesn't really matter. The house was destroyed anyway, but if it flooded first, there can be some confusion there if it's the worst of all cases, right, Tim?
There can, and there was a lot of confusion after Katrina as a result of that. But I think that the industry has gotten better with calculating that. I think consumers are better with that. And obviously with government being involved, hopefully less than more, let's don't have another situation like that. But, that had never occurred before event.
Let me open the phone lines here, the Oconar Jeweler Talk and Text Line. If you have any questions for the Insurance Commissioner, Tim Temple, you text them in to 504-260-1870. Don't ever text and drive as we talk about insurance and safety and so forth. Don't ever text and drive, 504-260-1870. And I'll pass them along and read them to the Commissioner, and he can respond. Tim, when it comes to flood insurance, and this could be a rain event, nobody knows what's going to happen. I had a conversation with Bill Cassidy about President Trump, and for years, representatives told me that all Joe Biden had to do when flood risk rating 2.0 came out was issue an executive order and do away with it. And my question to him was, well, if that's the case, then given the stroke that the Louisiana delegation has with Steve Scalise and Mike Johnson, the majority leader and Speaker of the House, respectively, well, why can't they say, oh, by the way, Mr. President, if you don't mind, the people in my state are just dying here as they are in other places with risk 2.0 and there's suits going on about the methodology involved and everything. How about we go back to what it was and pause that? And Senator Cassidy said that he was going to have his staff on it. I've not heard anything back. Do you know if it's as easy when it comes to flood insurance as the president signing an executive order to change it?
Well, you know, Tommy, that obviously that's a federal issue, but I had not heard that it could be undone with an executive order. That's the first I've heard of that. If that is correct, I would encourage the president to do that.
I don't know, Tim, but I know that for years they were saying, well, Biden this, Biden that, Biden the other thing. And I'm no Biden fan. I'm no Trump fan. I'm not the only person I like really elected officials is Tim Temple. That's the only guy that I like, honestly, if you want to. No, but seriously, I just care about policy and the way they do things. And it just seems like, well, somebody's, you know, speaking of rain, is it raining or are you doing, you know, what on my leg? Can it be changed by executive order or not? Because if it can be, why don't we use the power that Louisiana has and get something done about it? If not, well, then you were lying for all those years about what a Democratic president could do or not do. We'll talk with Tim Temple more about insurance when we return. I got a couple of auto insurance questions. So everything's on the table here. If you got a question for the insurance commissioner, text them in. I'll pass them along when we come back. 721 traffic now, WWL. 726, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Tim Temple, Louisiana Insurance Commissioner, whom I like. Tim, I like the way that you stand up, you take responsibility for what you're doing. Who knows if it's going to work, if not, but you own what you advise and what you recommend, and I respect that, I do. Somebody texted in and said, can the commissioner explain the insurance and tax benefits of a fortified roof as it currently stands? I'm sure he can, and he will right now. Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, Tommy, the fortified roof, two ways to get a fortified roof. One, you go through the Louisiana Fortified Roof Grant Program. You become an applicant. If you're awarded the grant, then the state pays up to $10,000 to fortify your roof. The second way is if you choose to purchase the fortified roof yourself, put it on yourself, whether you're building a home or replacing a roof, you can now get up to a $10,000 tax deduction, thanks to Senator Kirk Talbot, who was able to get that legislation passed. So you'll either get the $10,000 grant, so free money from the state, or you pay for it and you get a $10,000 tax deduction. It's one or the other. You can't get duplication of benefit there. And in addition to that, you will get a reduction in your premium through your home, your insurance carrier, if they're a admitted carrier, not a surplus lines carrier, an admitted carrier, because every admitted carrier in the state has a filed discount with the Department of Insurance. They're not all the same. Some are more, some are less, but every company has a filed discount with the Department of Insurance. And you can go to our website and find that information. And you can look to see if your insurance company has a discount. You can see what that range is. If your insurance company, if you don't like the number, if it's not big enough, you can get a fortified roof. And I want people to understand insurance companies like fortified roofs. So if you have a fortified roof, more insurance companies will compete to offer you a quote. So your insurance company you're with today may not have a good discount. You can get a fortified roof and become more attractive to other companies and get a bigger discount. But there are some substantial savings with a fortified roof.
Tim, you're of the industry, and that's how you made your living, and I think you know how it works on both sides now. And I would ask you, you know, I was saying earlier, I got a car that's 2014, and it's just nicked up here and there, and I'm thinking about getting a new car or not. And I had them look at it, and come to find out, it would be about $7,500 to fix it. The car is worth $7,000. My only point in this whole story is, what can people do to maybe take a look at their coverage and review it to make sure that they're not overpaying?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things where, you know, Tommy, I always encourage people to pick up the phone or go visit their insurance agent and sit down with them and have that conversation. You know, your agent is your can be your best friend when you've got a coverage issue, when you've got a coverage question, when you're dealing with premiums that are becoming unaffordable. You know, the insurance agent plays a key role. Again, whether it's independent or direct, that can be your best contact. But, you know, that scenario, that's one where I think an agent would say, look, do you want to continue to carry physical damage on the vehicle? Is it worth that?
It would seem to me.
How much money do you save?
Tim, you being in a business, it would seem to me, and I'm not trying to get personal advice here, but it's like, well, just carry the liability because it's already totaled, right?
Well, yeah, and again, I think that's where, yeah, you can have that conversation with your agent, and then you can make that determination. How much are you going to save? Is it worth it or not? But, you know, Tommy, the other thing, and I always tell people, you know, the Department of Insurance is here. We can answer questions. We can't give you personal advice on a situation like that, but we can give you the information, that arm you with information to go and sit down and talk with your insurance agent. And, you know, we're always available. The best way is, and I tell you, we launched an app last year, LDI Connect. And you can go on there. You can get answers to your questions. It gives you contact information to the department, claims information. It's a real wealth of knowledge, weather information. So I would encourage your listeners to download that app.
LDI Connect. Thank you, Tim. Have a great weekend. Well, weekend. It's only Wednesday, but good.
Take the rest of the week. Yeah, it's a few days off.
Sure. All right. Tim Temple, Louisiana Insurance Commissioner. When we come back, we're going to talk to the president of St. Bernard Parish about getting ready for storm preparations, and he was hopping into the drain himself and taking some tires out. We'll tell you when we come back. Right now, time for
What We Spend is a new podcast that explores something we almost never talk about. Every week, you'll hear a different guest share everything they spend their money on. What We Spend is available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
WWL First News. Hi, it's 7:45, quarter till 8. Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined now by the pride of Toka, Louisiana, Louis Pomez, St. Bernard Parish President. Morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing good.
I don't know if I've ever spoken to you or not, but it's a pleasure. Thanks for coming on. Tell me what St. Bernard Parish is doing to get ready for this event. Give me the timing on it as far as what you're hearing and what you did yesterday, which I think is kind of interesting, of the day before. The floor is yours, sir.
Well, we actually prepare all year long for heavy rain events and hurricane season. You know, we got part of St. Bernard Parish that is outside hurricane protection in the eastern end of our parish. So, well, we have tide protection levees down there and pump stations. And so we have a group of guys that maintain those levees and do inspections on those levees to make sure we're safe on the eastern end. And then everything on the west side of that's hurricane protection. We have the guys out on a regular basis that are flushing drains, cleaning drainage canals. A couple of years back, we inherited another 60 miles of drainage canal and 8 major drainage pump stations. And, you know, it was only about 65% pump capacity with those pump stations. Today, we had 100% pump capacity with those pump stations, and we have pretty much all of our drainage canals. We had the vegetation and settlement removed out of most of these canals in St. Bernard Parish. We still have a few miles of canal left that we're working on. You know, we have quite a few. We have 5 different locations that we set up for sandbag operations, where the residents of St. Bernard Parish can come in and bag their own sandbags and take what they need. pretty much what we do.
And tell me what you did about getting tires out of the drainage system yesterday. Was that you or somebody else?
Well, no, that was myself and my team, my public works team from the road yard. It's good. I started in government back in 1981, and I've never left government. Mm-hmm. So I had a great opportunity to work under the police jury system. I had great opportunity. I worked under every parish president St. Bernard has ever had in a full-time position. So learning everything in field operations, I've always had a great responsibilities in field operations. So, over the four decades of the knowledge and experience of knowing the directions of the drains and the size of the pipes and the location of the manholes and things like that, it's a big help. So every now and then I have to get out in the field and give the guys a little bit of knowledge.
See,
that's what we did.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
That's what we did yesterday. We went into a canal called the Blood Canal. It used to be an old slaughterhouse up in Harrabee and years ago, and there's an open ditch, an open canal. And it's named the Blood Canals, where all the blood would run through the canal when it was slaughtering the animals. Mm. And there was an axle must have broke off of a truck, off of a dually truck, with both tires still hooked together, went into the canal and wedged up in the inside of a 36-inch pipe. So, of course, the only way to get that out was to get some people to crawl in, hook some chains to it, and work it back out of that way. And that's what we did yesterday.
What I think is interesting about you is that, given your experience, especially when it comes to public works, I don't think anybody's going to snow you because you pretty well know the way everything works, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. When it comes to field operation, it doesn't matter what it is and the field operation, being involved for more than, it's actually this year, it makes 44 years of me being involved and, my new position as parish president, it's pretty much just simple math on running numbers and make sure that we can stay within the budget. But field operation, it takes a lot of knowledge and experience to run field operation. And I'm blessed with a lot of the workers that I had opportunities to work with. I still have workers here that's been with me 25, 30 years, So that goes a long ways with field operations, with our water and sewer. It's a lot of work with public works, with field operation, water and sewer, and our road department. It's a lot of work.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We'll go back, talk about the timing of this event, what your concerns are. And also, I want to talk about your hat, because I've never seen you without the hat. And I know you're a cattleman, and we'll talk about that as well. We're talking to Louis Pomez. I've never spoken to him before. St. Bernard Parish President seems like a very competent man. And if y'all are in St. Bernard and you got any questions, 504-260-1870. I'll pass them along. That's the Oakwood Jeweler talking text line. Please don't ever text and drive. Traffic now, WWL. Let's go ahead and round up. 7:57, 3 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Parish President Louis Pomez with St. Bernard. Mr. Parish President, you are a real cowboy, are you not, with the cowboy hat that I see you wearing all the time? Somebody texted in and said, fun fact, that you were a mounted deputy as well for some time in St. Bernard. So you are a cowboy. You know your way around these things, don't you?
Yeah, I did. I did a little bit of time with our sheriff's department, and still today I work very close with our Sheriff Pullman, and along with all of his deputies and detectives and narcotics agents. So, a little bit of experience throughout every branch of government in St. Bernard Parish.
But with the hat, you have a cattle business, don't you? Aren't you worried at some point in the cattle business?
I do. I have a couple hundred mama cows, and during calf season, we pretty much double a herd. It's pretty big, pretty nice size cattle ranch.
Head them up, move them out. Somebody wants to know about timeline. First of all, sandbag locations in St. Bernard Parish, and somebody wants to know about timeline with the rain event when you're concerned.
Okay. As of right now, the sandbags, we're going to have five different locations for sandbags. I can give you them addresses. It's going to be at the St. Bernard Port at 100 Port Boulevard in Chalmette. It's better known by the Kaiser.
You know what might be better, Louis, if you can just give me a website where people can go? Is there one?
Yeah, St. Bernard Parish Government website. Yep.
You're spelling all that out?
Yep. Okay. St. Bernard Parish.
St. Bernard Parish Government. You can find out where the locations are. Somebody texting in, as you mentioned, the port
Homeland
about, sir?
That's correct. Homeland Security.
All right. About the port in St. Bernard Parish, and has anything changed between when you were running and now? Your thoughts on that port, and what is the status of that being built in St. Bernard Parish?
Well, that's we're under litigation with that situation with the port. There's not a whole lot that I can say because of the litigation going on, but there's concerns of the roadway, there's concerns of the rail traffic, and there's also concerns of the river traffic.
So timing again on the rain event for this weekend, your main concern is what? What are they telling you?
Well, our main concern is we're looking at more into this afternoon after between 1 o'clock and 3 o'clock. We may be getting hit with some heavy showers, but tomorrow, I think Thursday and Friday, we're expecting more heavy rain. I think that's going to be our two worst days. We're looking at the forecast right now to see what the situation is going to be for Thursday and Friday.
Thank you, sir. Pleasure, as always. Good to talk to you. Louis Pomez. And look, don't take this wrong, but I hope we don't talk to you a lot during hurricane season, because that means everything's going fine, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you. We'll talk to Ronald Surpass about crime. We come back here on WWL. Now on this Wednesday morning, and the rain's going to come in this afternoon, primarily tomorrow, though, and Friday. And you can go to sbpg.net to find out about sandbag locations in St. Bernard Parish, sbpg.net. And the tributes continue to pour in for Louis Pomez, the St. Bernard Parish president, who was at one time a mounted police officer, as was our next guest, Ronald Surpass, professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD superintendent, head of the Nashville City Police, and the Washington State Police. Good morning, Chief. How are you?
Tommy, I'm wonderful. How are you today?
I am okay, sir. When it comes to, before we get to the topic at hand, you know I always like to pick your brain. As an officer with a mounted unit, since we talked to Louis Pomez, and he happened to be one as well, what are the tricks to keeping that horse under control when it comes to crowd control with a mounted police unit?
Well, that's a great question. It's two very important things. One is the training of the horse, right? We do a lot. We used to have a really wonderful, and they may still, post-Mardi Gras annual training where mounted units would come from all over the country to work with us as we showed how we worked horse training. The second thing is the officer themselves, right? I started riding a horse, having never ridden a horse in my life. Mm-hmm. And the training provided me the opportunity to learn how to technically manage it. But you got to learn how to understand the size of that animal and what that animal's appearance can do when it's suddenly in a crowd of people. And you got to learn how to control how you feel as well. In New Orleans, we can't do it without mounted units. I think you've heard me say this before. In Nashville, we had 7 horses. Mm. In New Orleans, we had over 40. In New Orleans, we don't have a single helicopter. In Nashville, we had 7 helicopters. Different communities, different sizes need different tools. New Orleans has to have mounted units. Glad to know that the president rode and I rode, and I still have a picture of me and Skippy here in my office. And I wanted to tell you, the New Orleans Police Department mounted unit was 100 years old in 2025. The unit was formed in 1925 and has been consistently used for 100 years.
At any point did Skippy say, one of you has to get off? I'm just kidding. It's an old joke. You're a big man. It's just a joke, and I'm playing. Let me ask you.
No, when I came back, my horse, Emily, was actually the horse I rode before I left. Mm-hmm. Big, beautiful animal, 17 hands. Mm-hmm. And when I got back, I started riding her again, and she turned around and looked at me. She said, well, I recognize this ass.
It's my fault. I rang the bell. Once you ring the bell, you can't unring it. But since we're talking about animals,
right. Talk
about the importance of the canine unit as well, Chief, because a lot of times, you know, we'll see a unit every now and then that says canine and it gets our attention. But talk about the importance and the contributions that canines make and canine units make to police departments.
Let's work backwards from what they do that's not consistent on the television show. Canine dogs now are trained to be IED, looking for improvised explosive devices. I've actually witnessed in some of my consultancy canine dogs that are trained to smell the glue that holds computers, hard drives together, mm-hmm. So looking for them in prisons. Mm. Canines can smell any number of chemical smells, and you train them to train the one that you want them to be looking for. Canines can do a phenomenal job in all these techniques, and we also use them for they call it patrol work. If someone is hiding in a building and it's more advantageous to send a canine officer and the dog, the officer's still going, to find the person. We don't do as much of that as we used to, but these dogs that can smell bomb chemicals, that can smell narcotics chemicals, that can smell, even I just found this out a couple years ago, it blew my mind away, the smell of a certain glue that is used to hold hard drives mm-hmm. on cell phones to help prisons find out if people are hiding cell phones. They're wonderful. They make a big difference at a lot of places.
And when it comes to the psyche of the criminal or the suspect, whatever you want to call them, the perpetrator, it's different when it comes to an animal, whether it's a horse or a dog, because maybe you might be able to read how a human acts or think you're in their head. But with an animal, it's completely different, right, from the person's perspective, the perp's perspective?
Absolutely. You've been downtown during Mardi Gras. I've been downtown during Mardi Gras. And I say this not to be snippy, but it is true. I mean, if you have a crowd of people in Mardi Gras that is so thick it can't move, and you have someone who's been hurt or someone you need to get a fire truck through a crowd, when the business end of Trigger shows up in a crowd, you'll be stunned how people find some place to go.
Yeah, and
a police officer can be standing there screaming all day long, and you use the horse in a safe way to signal to people, hey, we need to clear a path, and it works every time.
And sometimes you do that just to keep the crowd moving, right? Don't they do that?
Absolutely. Tommy, you're reading out of the playbook. When I was a young cop walking Bourbon Street, I learned early on that the police department had relationships with the bars that had balconies and the mounted unit, and the purpose is to keep the crowd moving. Whenever a crowd stops, it's starting to become like molecules bumping into each other, and the next thing you know, trouble could happen. So during my era, and I don't think it's any different now, we had rotational deals with the balcony bars to just close your balcony for a few minutes, let people move around. And I was a mounted officer for many years on Bourbon Street, and that was our purpose, was just go walk through the crowd, not just walk through the crowd slowly, make some friends, but keep people moving.
You said I'm reading from the playbook. I'm neither tall or good looking, but I'm not stupid. 8:20, we'll take a break, come back, talk about the murder rate, or at least some people would say I'm not. Talk about the murder rate with Chief Ronald Surpass, 8:20 traffic, WWL. 8:26, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Ronald Surpass, former NLPD superintendent, a professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, and a consultant. You'll see him on TV occasionally on this network or that. Chief, when it comes to murders in New Orleans, I think we're talking about in the neighborhood of 50-ish or something along those lines. For a while, New Orleans was the murder capital of the world. And then, and this is not to in any way diminish what happened on New Year's Day, but in that number are, I think it's 14 people that got killed in the January 1st terror attack. So nothing just happens. The murder rate is down for a reason. Why is that, and how do you maintain it?
Let's do some context. In the decade of the 90s, the city averaged for that decade about 344 murders a year. In the decade of the 2000s, about 209 murders a year. In the decade of the 10s, about 145 murders a year. And in the decade of the 20s, about 192. Mm-hmm. If we have a murder count this year of victims lost to families, that's the lowest it's been in 50 years, that's always great news. But the question is, the question of murder is found in one of the oldest books to ever think to exist, which is the Bible. So we've had people killing each other for as long as we have recorded history. There are things that we can do as a government. But at the end of the day, if a police department could stop all murders, we would have no murders. So the fact they're going down is a good news, but it's not just the police. It's going to be other factors. And police chiefs in my generation started to get a little more confident in telling the community it's going down and we think that's good. But we know we didn't do this by ourselves. Mm-hmm. Something else had to change. The number of children who are coming through in cohorts, the ability of better medical care, the ability of better investigations, less opportunities to miss the chance to interrupt domestic or intimate personal violence. But what we still have in America is young men in groups who have no care about anyone around them shooting a lot of people. So it's a great story because we have less families losing family members. It's a balanced story because if any government could stop them, there'd be none. Mm-hmm.
And that's never going to happen. So I guess what I'm saying is, you know, just in
if the Bible's right, it's never going to happen, right? I mean, the Bible said, thou shalt not kill. That's how long that's been a principle of society.
So
sorry to interrupt.
That's all right. So if whatever it is, whether it's a sporting event, whether it's gaining an audience, whatever it is, it's hard enough to get a lead or to get to where you want to be, but it sometimes can be more challenging to stay that way. Are the things in place, in your opinion, to keep us trending in the right direction?
I think so. I think the opportunity for digital forensics investigations, DNA continues to be a very powerful identifier. Digital forensics is identifier. Facial recognition, while it's used more around the world than it is in our communities because of politics, facial recognition is another identifier. It eliminates people that you don't want to waste your time looking at. So that makes efficiency of investigations. And look, I've done a lot of homicide investigation review around the country. And the number one issue is great supervision helps great detectives to be better. It's just that simple. No matter what the community engagement is, great supervision helps great detectives be better.
Which brings us back to and something you've been saying for a long, long time about what's the right number of police officers, right?
Exactly right. The next mayor has to put a nail on that. They've got to get somebody to come in here and tell them what is the calls for service demand. We're creating science. My group and I and others are creating science right now to determine the number of detectives. And you can't just keep saying we should be 1,200 or 1,600 and demoralizing the community and demoralizing the officers. If the number is something different, level set, get on the same page. I'm asking every mayoral candidate to commit to bringing in experts to tell us what is a rational, evidence-based estimate of the size of the New Orleans Police Department in 26 and then going forward to 30 and 35. Tommy, cities all over America managed to get this done. We need our city to do it so we can focus on what we have to do to be successful in policing. And I think it's just a simple solution. You just get somebody who knows what they're doing and have them come in and look with clean eyes.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. Ronald Sir, past professor, practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola. And, of course, it's not about just policing, as the chief will tell you. There are a lot of other things involved in that as well. We'll take a break and back. Talk to Coop, Mike Cooper, president of St. Tammany Parish. Right now, time for WWL First News. 8:47, 13 till 10. We're trying to get in touch with Mike Cooper, president of St. Tammany Parish, to talk about preparations there and sandbag locations and all of that stuff. And we are joined now by Coop, Mike Cooper, president of St. Tammany Parish. How you doing, Mike?
Doing great, Tommy. It's great to hear from you.
It's good to hear from you. You know, we're just talking, shooting a breeze here about the best way to eat ice cream. Some people are saying let it melt in a container until almost liquid, refreeze it so it forms ice crystals. That, to me, is the worst of all worlds. Somebody else says the best way is to take it right out of the container and eat it cold and frozen. I like it kind of soupy. Since we got a second here, how do you like it, Mike? How do you like your ice cream?
I don't like it soupy. If I have a cone, I like eating it from the bottom up.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but what about in a bowl?
If it's a bowl, I'll pour the chocolate syrup on vanilla mm-hmm. and stir it up a little bit, but I like to eat it close to frozen.
You got to stir it up like it's soup for me. Let's talk about sandbag locations in St. Tammany Parish and this weather event, time frame, your concerns, etc. Mike?
Thank you, Tommy. Appreciate the opportunity to share with our citizens. You asked about sandbag locations. We opened up yesterday at noon. We have five locations across the parish from Covington, Mandeville, Lacombe, and two in the Slidell area. It's at our public works barns where our citizens are used to picking up and providing their own shovels to fill up sandbags that we provide. So all day today, dawn to dusk, will be available, weather permitting, for our citizens to utilize this service. We're concerned, of course, with bands of heavy rainfall that may cause some flooding in low-lying areas, and we ask our citizens to be prepared for that. Low-lying areas meaning areas close to Lake Pontchartrain, areas close to waterways, and ask them to be prepared, but the sandbags should help if needed, but be prepared if roadways are closed due to inundation. We're expecting rain later today, this evening, throughout the day tomorrow, and possibly into Friday, and maybe some Saturday. So just be ready for heavy bands of rain in the next few days.
Mike, when it comes to flooding, or not flooding, wait, don't get ahead of myself here. Hang on a second. When it comes to concerns, is it about rainfall or are there any tidal concerns? And I'm thinking about the lakefront, et cetera, in Mandeville.
It's regarding the rain, the heavy rainfall, if projected at this time, could be over the next few days, 5 to 7 inches of rain. The tides are low. They call them neap tides. So the tides are medium to low, and coastal flooding due to the tides is not expected, but it could be heavy rains could prevent the water from moving out as it normally would. So we ask our citizens to be cognizant of that if you do live in low-lying areas or in areas where roadways tend to go underwater with heavy rains.
Mike, how concerned are you? What are they telling you? A scale of 1 to 10, like with businesses and, well, not schools because it's summertime, but just those kinds of things, everyday activities. Are you concerned this is going to be disruptive or not?
I don't think so. Heavy rains.
You know how you always want to know about everyone else's money? On the podcast What We Spend, guests will, for 1 week, tell us everything they spend their money on.
My son slammed $6 worth of blueberries in 5 minutes.
And everything that makes them feel.
I want to own a house. I want to have a child. But this morning, I really wanted a coffee.
Because at the end of the day, money is always about more than your balance. Listen to and follow What We Spend, an Odyssey original podcast. Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
It's good to have a warning when we have heavy rains coming. We don't foresee, businesses closing or asking our citizens to refrain from doing their normal work activities. However, just keep in mind if it's safe to be off the roadways when it's heavy pouring rain, and just keep that in mind. With regards to, trees being down or limbs being down, that's always a concern. There may be some small gusts of wind. Our utility companies are prepared. They're prepared to respond in the event of power outages. Our public works departments are prepared to respond in the event of down limbs in major roadways and our parish roadways. We've been preparing with clearing out our local ditches and drainage features and lowering the elevations of the water elevations in our retention ponds. So we're doing what we normally would do during this time of year, which is hurricane season. So we're prepared for incidents like this.
Mike, somebody texts in about the sandbags. Is there a limit? Or I know you got to bring your own shovel, but is there a limit or can they get what they need?
Well, no, there's no limit, but please be respectful to your neighbors. But there's no limit. We see people here. One of the locations is at Coop Drive. Yes, Coop Drive is where our main office is located.
Spelled with a K, just to be clear.
Spelled with a K. All right. Spade with a K, but we see our citizens coming in and out right now, picking up and filling up their sandbags. There may be a miscellaneous shovel at each location. We may have somebody there to help in the event a citizen does need help, but there's no limit. But please be respectful of your neighbors.
And, of course, the idea is not to level out your yard. The idea is to get some sandbags if you need them. Only real quick, what would you advise people to do just in the interim between now and then?
Continue to monitor our radio stations, our local TV meteorologists, National Weather Service, and just be prepared for heavy rains. And if you do not need to be on the highways and local roads driving during heavy rains, please refrain from doing so. Stay safe. And we have a number, 985-898-2338, which is a non-emergency number, but it's a number that can be reached to provide services where needed.
What's the number again, Mike? 985?
898-2338.
And what's the website?
Our website is stpgov.org.
All right, thank you, sir. Appreciate it, Mike. Stay dry.
Thank you, Tommy.
You bet. Mike Cooper, president of St. Tammany Parish. Airport Public Works Barn on in Slidell, Fritchie Public Works Barn, Keller Public Works Barn, St. Tammany Parish Government Complex, and Covington Public Works Barn. You can get your sand bags in St. Tammany Parish, but you got to bring your own shovel. 854, 6 till 9, traffic now, WWL. Quick reminder about sports talk today. Very special guest could be in the huddle. Saints legendary defensive end Cam Jordan is going to be on to talk about the offseason, the upcoming season, and his pickleball tournament. Cam Jordan today at 420 here on Saints Radio WWL. And we got company in the studio. It's nice to have company. And Miss Sandra Herman's here, president and CEO of the Celebrate Canal Coalition, who has been with us before, and we don't get a lot of company. So it's nice to see you, and thanks for visiting.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Tell me about the Celebrate Canal Coalition. What is all that about?
Well, it's a citizen-led initiative, and I came here to talk with you. I think you were my first interview, and you were so nice and friendly and encouraging. So,
well, I love Canal Street, and I love the city. Matter of fact, let me interrupt for one second, because I want to bring the audience in on the Okunard Jeweler Talk and Text Line at 504-260-1870. Don't ever text and drive, please, because we'll send Tim after you if you do. 504-260-1870. If you have any questions about Canal Street, concerns about Canal Street, or maybe you want to share one of your fondest Canal Street memories, I'd love to share those with the audience. I'm sorry, Sandra. I just wanted to get that in. So
that's okay. A little over a year ago, I attended a meeting, and just to review, Michael Heck was talking about how great New Orleans was going to be during this year. And one of the ladies raised her hand and said, what are we going to do about Canal Street? And he said, it's going to take a citizen-led initiative to get anything done. So having spent 20 years in state government and organizing projects like this, I successfully went to the legislature and got an authorization of $83 million to do projects around the Atchafalaya, built welcome centers, parks, those kinds of things. So I thought, I can do this. Mm-hmm. I know how to bring people together. And so we formed our initiative. We actually kicked it off August the 14th of last year. So in 1 year, we have sponsored many public events. I decided to do this in two parts. One part is getting families and friends back to Canal Street to feel comfortable. So we had our Windows on Canal art initiative.
Tell people what that was.
We hired local artists to design installations to put above these buildings that would talk about the history of the building. So, and of course, we had our favorite dog, Scrim. The storyline is he is going down Canal Street. He meets one of the critters that New Orleans is famous for, and he learns about the history of the building. So we did. In fact, there's one more month left that people can still come down and see those wonderful installations. Now, some of these are 16 feet tall and 20 feet wide. You see them from the street, and they're just beautifully done.
Extending from where to where, Sandra?
We have seven buildings. So we actually, this program is from the river to all the way to the interstate.
Okay, to Claiborne Avenue.
And so, yes, and so that is part of my program. And we had kids scavenger hunts and turned out lots of parents with kids. We had an architecture tour where we took people hop on a bus at the top, and we parked in the middle of one block, looked across the street, heard from John Williams and Ryan Bordenave about the amazing stories of those buildings. It was sold out, and so we're going to continue to do those once the weather cools down. And so we've got a lot of things planned to keep people coming back to Canal Street. And top of mind, this has to be restored. this has to be brought back. And so now we're starting our public meetings. We have one tonight, public safety. It's at the Hyatt Centric, and we have DA Jason Williams telling us how they are bringing crime down using technology. And I love that. The whole idea is, yeah, you've got the whole all of New Orleans to protect, but use technology to identify where the crime is actually taking place. So they started doing that, and they've gone into these areas, found the all-night bars and gas stations, shut them down. The crime is gone from the neighborhood. They are brought back ball games and in the nearby parks. This is just an example of how you can use technology to help bring crime down. In fact, the crime stats are amazing mm-hmm. right now for New Orleans.
They really are.
Yeah.
Especially if you take out, and again, in no way am I trying to minimize this at all, but if you take out the New Year's Day anomaly, and again,
yes.
I'm not trying to minimize any of that,
right.
but the numbers would be even more extraordinary.
Yes.
Tell me, for people that don't remember, let's talk a little bit about the history of Canal Street, because I can remember being a little bitty kid, and the only thing I could compare it to with that big, I think it was a Canadian Club sign, if I remember correctly, was Times Square. It reminded me of, like, New Orleans' version of Times Square. Am I off base there?
No, that's exactly right. We had the widest street in the country. We had the big shopping department stores, D.H. Holmes, Maison Blanche. And so when I was putting this together, I would just randomly ask people, did you ever go to Canal Street? And they would say, oh, my goodness, my mama dressed us up, my grandma. We'd start at Krause's. Krause's was big in everybody's memory because I think that's where the bus let everybody off. And, of course, they had the material people used to sew back then. And so they'd start at Krause's. They would walk up and down, pardon me, the street, store window shopping. They remember getting lunch at a counter. One guy told me, yeah, I remember I ordered from the kids' menu little red hen chicken. Mm. I mean, the memories. And you know what? When you really delve into it, it's the feeling. It's the walking down the street, seeing friends, feeling the energy of – and maybe that's the way Times Square is. And, of course, we studied
– You've been to Times Square.
Yes. Yeah. Now that it's fixed, but we have a documentary of back when it was bad. Mm-hmm. CD, we have a little video that says there were 6 felony arrests a day mm-hmm. in Times Square. So what they did is they started by restoring. They had a lot of old theaters that were being used for X-rated movies and porno movies.
It was awful.
Yeah.
It was awful.
So they got Eisner, who was head of Disney at the time, to come and tour their oldest theater, and he did, and they said, we want you to restore this. He said, I'll do it under 2 conditions. Number one, you guarantee me my people, my employees will be safe. And number two, you'll surround us with family-oriented stores. And
like
they
the
M&M guaranteed
shop,
that.
For example,
yeah.
right? And
yeah.
That
so that's what we're looking at. Again, the memories are so intense about people in Canal Street. And I just knew this will be a success, the main reason why the people want it. And we have a citizen-led initiative. No one's in here to make a big payday. Everybody's in for the good of New Orleans.
Organic is what I'm thinking,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. So I'm a very lucky person. I start something like this and teams of people come in to help that have great ideas. So we're pulling together ideas about, you know, where do you start? We have blocks 600 to 1,000 that have the great older buildings that are, you know, really well done. We're going to start with clusters of projects on either end. Down there by the Sanger, from the Sanger all the way to the bridge, we need to upgrade that. And I want that to be a family theme. I want to restore the Lowe's Theater. I'd like to make a children's theater there. I'd like to surround it with Lego stores and those types of things, Disney store. And incidentally, Disney's coming through with an exhibit that they're touring around the country next March of Princess and the Frog, which is about Leah
right.
Chase.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'd like to do something with Disney. On the other end, down towards the river, there's a cluster of properties and lots that we can come up with some projects. We need to go big. We need to have five major projects at one time, all being designed and built together. Because you can do one project at a time. It will take decades, and the buildings are deteriorating. Mm-hmm. This has to be serious. And once you show that New Orleans and the state is ready to actually do something big, we're one of the last cities to revitalize their Main Street. Once they see this critical mass, it will bring in the developers and investors from around the country. So we've given ourselves a timeline of next May to get all of this done, and a package deal where we have incentives. You know, our governor has given huge incentives to Meta to build that plant in Richland Parish. $600 million to a car plant in Donaldsonville. This is New Orleans. This is Canal Street. We're the engine for the rest of the state. So I think it will not be difficult, but everyone needs to work together. This needs to be everybody from the stakeholders, the public, the citizens. It's got to be a unanimous pull to make it happen.
We need to take a break. Let me tell you what I love about you.
Okay.
Is that I often preach that nothing just happens. I don't care if it's setting up chairs at a PTA meeting. I don't care if it's donuts at a 12-step meeting. Whatever it is, nothing just happens.
That's
People
right.
need to do it, and you have to have a vision to do it.
That's right.
You seem to me to be a lady who knows that.
Yes.
And also has a vision, mm-hmm. not just a vision, but knows how to take the steps to get from here to there. Am I reading you right?
You're correct.
I think
Thank
so.
You, Tommy.
We'll take some more. We'll take your text at 504-260-1870, your Canal Street memories, and we'll try to get some details on what Canal Street could look like. And I would ask you also on that Oakenard Jeweler Talk and Text line at 504-260-1870, what would you like to see Canal Street look like? Because having been to New York, and it's been a while now, but Times Square is just as family-friendly as it possibly could be, and attracts gosh knows how many thousands of people, so you would think we could do the same thing here. You would think. 922 back in the flash, talking about Canal Street, Tommy Tucker with Sandra Herman, President and CEO of the Celebrate Canal Coalition, back in a flash. Having an interesting hour, 928 now, talking to Sandra Herman, having some in-studio company, which is nice. She's the President and CEO of the Celebrate Canal Coalition. We're talking off the air, and I think it's amazing the way you said it, Sandra, about ideas. How did you phrase it?
If money were no object, what would you like to see on Canal Street? Because we are now in the phase where we're trying to come up with new ideas. People are bored with just going shopping. We know we need upscale retail, but we want experiential stores and events. So we want everyone to just put in their ideas, and we're going to be spending the next couple of months, 2 or 3 months, putting together these ideas and putting the financing packages, getting the supporters. It's going to happen. We're just excited.
And going to the nothing just happens concept, you got to think big. You can't mm-hmm. rule anything out. Somebody texted in here, and I'd like you to address this. They said, let's be New Orleans. Let's certainly not imitate NYC. Yuck. But first of all, I don't think everything New York does is bad. I think that is so wrong when it comes to, and I'm not trying to criticize the listener. I'm glad you sent this in. But I just think from a conceptual standpoint, it's so off base because you can't rule it out because New York City does it, nor can you say it's got to be uniquely New Orleans, right?
Oh, I think it will be uniquely New Orleans. I mean, but we do – what I love, too, are the ideas for lighting up the architectural buildings. New York City uses lighting very, very well, and that goes along with the public safety, too. The more lighting you have, the better. But, yes, we want to there will always be a New Orleans twist to everything we do.
Somebody says, I know we have Riverwalk, but I always thought Canal Street could be revitalized as an outlet mall. Again, thank you for texting. For my opinion, that would be the last thing I'd want to see. Thoughts?
Right. Yeah. No, we do, as I mentioned.
And I thank you for texting in. I'm not criticizing your opinion. I'm just saying
my
opinion.
Yeah, keep those ideas coming in. But no, we want it to be we want you to stroll again, do window shopping, and there will be some good stores. But no, we have outgrown the shopping bug. We now want, you know, stores and places that where people can go in. Kids can have experience something, whether it's VR, virtual reality, illuminations, just a lot of fun things. And by the way, one of the things we want to do is to have a green space where we can do outdoor concerts down there on that end where the family events will take place. So
almost like a World Fair amphitheater kind of thing that was on the river. Do you remember?
No,
that? No,
no, something like what goes on at Lafayette Square.
Oh, okay, I got you. Like the Wednesdays at the Square thing.
Yeah,
which is certainly a great event. Somebody texted in. I have a physician friend that's heavily involved in real estate, and you should see his eyes light up when he talks about parking spaces.
Oh.
This man is passionate about parking spaces like nobody else because I guess he grasps the value of them.
Yes.
How big of a challenge is that, Sandra, when it comes to parking and attracting people to Canal Street?
Parking is huge. We've got to do some well-designed parking that is affordable, and parking garages are part of it. Now, we can do parking garages that have stores on the first two floors, but there's a lot of empty space down at that end near the Sanger, near where Lowe's Children's Theater will be. So I envision parking garages as part of the future, but they have to be well designed and they have to have the appropriate stores.
Give me some ideas of things that you've heard or thoughts of what it might look like in terms of appropriate stores. I'm trying to envision this.
Well, on the family end, it would have.
Now, by family end, we're talking from the Sanger to Claiborne or the other.
Yes,
way? Yeah,
no,
Sanger
to Claiborne. Okay. Not all the way to Claiborne. Part of that is the Bio District.
Okay,
but there's enough property there to do a lot of meaningful things. Legos, Disney stores. We're right now gathering those ideas as well as the green space. I'm open. I want to hear what and we heard yesterday virtual reality stores. But yes, we have to have parking. I want to do some parking in the middle of the street as well. The other end has parking, but there can be a cluster of stores at the other end. You have Canal Place. Down there you have the Four Seasons, Canal Place, the casino. We need upscale shopping down at that end. I'm heartbroken about the Palace Cafe, mm-hmm. hoping that they will work out a compromise to keep that cafe there. It's just so much a part of Canal Street.
Ian McNulty and I were talking about that on Friday, and a question mm-hmm. that popped into my mind is Canal Street, remembering it as I did from being a little kid, as being the Times Square, right, in New
yes.
Orleans and the big neon signs and so
yes.
forth.
Mm-hmm.
How did it get to where it is today? How did that happen? Because I think that's part of keeping it, bringing it back and keeping it from regressing again, right?
Yes, well, this happened all over the country. The big department stores, Maison Blanche, D.H. Holmes, they all go out to the malls. And that happened around the turn of the century. And when there's a vacuum, the T-shirts, the souvenirs, the liquor stores fill that vacuum. And so that's how – and then people just gave up on it. And a year ago, all I heard were negative comments, crime, decay, why you want to get involved in Canal Street. That has changed in a year. Now people are excited about it. And we have to demand that we have upscale. And critical mass will bring the big players in. And, you know, people say, where will the money come from? There's enough money out there. There is enough money to do Canal Street. Top of the line. There's billionaires, there's foundations, there's money out there. We can't think small. This has got to be big. It's got to be breathtakingly big. So we're in it to hear the big ideas. And, you know, some people that have moved here from New York recently, businessman, I won't give his name. He says, the problem with New Orleans, and I love, they don't think big enough. Mm-hmm. He said, I've been in the big cities. They know how to do it big. You can't let dollar numbers scare you.
And that's what I was trying to say before, I guess, in my own clumsy way. I think sometimes we hold ourselves back by thinking, well, no, it's too big. It's not this. It's not that. It's not, quote, genuinely New Orleans, but that's not the case at all, right?
Right, right.
And the other thing I wanted to ask you is two questions. First of all, you reminded me of one, so I'm going to get to it right now. What is it about Canal Street that really struck a chord with you that made you, because you're an accomplished woman, you don't have to do this. What is it about Canal Street that lit a fire within you and made you want to get involved doing this?
Well, I love a challenge. I've spent my life working, and I've been retired for the past 15 years, worked with the ballet. I've been president of various organizations. But when I heard that, it's going to take a citizen-led initiative. And I started talking to people. And I remember my eighth grade class. Mm-hmm. I'm going to admit, you know, to you, and you already know, I graduated from grammar school, the eighth grade, in 1960. Our class trip was to New Orleans. And I can,
really?
Yes. And I can
remember.
And it was
from North Louisiana, right, or not? Or where?
No, this was actually in Pineville. I was living in Pineville at the time, center of the state. So,
well, to me, it's North Louisiana.
Yeah, right, right. I graduated from high school in Monroe.
Okay.
But Pineville, and we rode buses down there. And, of course, we went to the dock, and all the Chiquita bananas were mm-hmm. coming in. That was an event. But then we walked down Canal Street, and there was just something about walking down Canal Street. And I heard people speaking a foreign language for the first time in my life. And I was so – I felt like I was in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
But just hearing from locals, especially, you know, one of the announcers on one of the TV shows the other morning said, yeah, my grandma, I used to go with her, and she would tell me, now sit over there, I'm going to go look at the foundations. Now, of course, we know that was the proper word for underwear. When women said, I'm going to be looking at foundations, you behave yourself. Mm-hmm. He remembered, you know, people will have the most interesting memories of Canal Street. It was that important to people. And when people say, what do you want to bring back? The feeling, that pride, that energy of walking down the street, seeing your friends, having people enjoying themselves. And by the way, that's the number one way to prevent crime, is when there are a lot of people enjoying themselves and having a good time. The drug dealers go somewhere else. The crime, the gang people, you know, it all goes away.
I think Krause's was a store with a mezzanine. I think that's where I learned what a mezzanine was. I might have that wrong. People will correct me if I'm wrong, but I had no idea what a mezzanine was.
Right.
Jordan Fiegel in there. Jordan is a magna cum laude graduate. I wonder if he knows what. Jordan Fiegel, do you know what a mezzanine is? A mezzanine. Do you know what that is? It has no idea. No, it's a floor between floors,
right.
I think, is what it is, right?
Right.
Yes. Let's take a break. We'll come back, continue the conversation with Sandra Herman, President, CEO of the Celebrate Canal Coalition. We're taking your ideas for what you would like to see Canal Street turn into, 504-260-1870. And one other thing I think that is interesting, what you talked about is, I don't know if you want to call it a force multiplier, but how it's important that five of these things go on at one time.
Exactly.
Because otherwise it takes forever. We'll also talk about financing and cooperation from state and the government. I think Billy Nungess is going to be there tonight or not?
Yeah. He's going to be there August 1st. Tonight is Jason Williams.
Tonight is Jason Williams. Mm-hmm. So we'll continue the conversation when we come back. I love the way Sandra Herman thinks, President and CEO of the Celebrate Canal Coalition. I was walking around when the Super Bowl was here, and I just thought it was delightful. Just, you know, sometimes we get so involved with ourselves, we forget what we have here with the riverfront and with Canal Street. And that's as it is now. So if you can let yourself imagine what it could be. And we'll also talk about the future of the city, where I think that could be really an anchor and a major resurrection point for the city. 9:39, 21 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 9:46, 14 till 10, never enough time with Sandra Herman, President and CEO of the Celebrate Canal Coalition. But you know, you have an open invitation whenever you want to stop by. Tell me what's underway now as it relates to Canal Street.
Right now, we have a Canal Street scavenger hunt that's sponsored by New Orleans Magazine from the 1st to the 31st. And at Celebrate Canal, or you can go to the New Orleans Magazine Instagram and also our website, CelebrateCanal.com. We want to get everybody's email addresses so we can send our monthly newsletter and you can keep up with what's going on. But this scavenger hunt, we gave them 20 places on Canal Street, and you go and you take your picture. For example, under the Adler's clock, you have to take a picture. A picture by the ferry, at Cafe Beignet, at the Sanger, at Meet a Rubenstein, I put. So you have to go in the store, get your picture taken with one of the Rubensteins. I kidded
awesome.
With them. I said, there's always one of y'all here. Uh-huh. And they loved it. So, and people are turning them in, and it's, and there are prizes, for the people that do more than 10. I want somebody to do all 20. You know, it's only a mile long. Mm-hmm. And those that do a 20 or that do the most will get a cash prize of $1,000. But those that are above 10 will get their names in a drawing, and they have a free night at Rubenstein Hotel, two nights at the Sheraton with access to VIP. There's a cooking lesson at the Ruby Slipper for their beignets and biscuits, I think. Is that – that's pretty much it, but lots of prizes, and then the cash prize. So get out there and take picture of yourself on Canal Street.
See, what I think is so great about that is it goes back to what I was saying about during the Super Bowl walking around. I mm-hmm. think we forget what we have here because we get isolated in our own neighborhoods or whatever it is, or we get busy with work. Maybe you're working from home, whatever is going on, but you forget what a resource, what an asset Canal Street is. And
yes.
What there is to enjoy there.
And with our big major projects, we want to link pedestrian-wise to both ends. We want you to be able to walk freely and comfortably from the river all the way to Claiborne. And so that the streetscaping will be very, very important.
And anything else that's going on that you want to mention?
We have not just the public safety tonight, but on August the 1st is our quarterly meeting with the Lieutenant Governor. On the 13th, we'll be talking about beautification and streetscaping, and they call it placemaking. On the 27th of August, we'll be talking about transportation and parking. And on September 17th, we'll be talking about retail. And another one of our free events we're finalizing now, the first Saints regular home game. We're doing Celebrate Canal and Celebrate the Saints at the Saint Hotel on
awesome.
Canal Street. So you'll go there. You'll have a mimosa, a Bloody Mary. It's a noon game. So we'll have a brass band. We'll get you in the mood to go to the game. So we're doing lots of – all of this is free and open to the public, everything we've done so far. And people are really feeling more comfortable about bringing their families back to Canal Street.
I think people forget about the walkability of the city as well. You know, one thing I was thinking of as we talk here, I like to put something innocuous on when I work out because I don't want to have to pay a lot of attention to it. But I find these shows on YouTube about stores that aren't here anymore, and I know it's America and one company buys the other, buys the other, buys the other, buys the other. But there are so many companies that used to be in existence that have been gobbled up. Does that make the challenge even harder of finding different people that are willing to invest in Canal Street and revitalize because there aren't that many companies left?
Right. Well, but they have plenty of money. Plenty of money.
Well, they have plenty of money. That's true.
And they can be presented with an opportunity. And hopefully once one big one comes in, for example, what I'd like to see at the Customs House is some big – if you walk in there, it is museum ready. Mm. And we were looking at bringing in – it's got to be a big corporate. Maybe Meta owes us an office staff down here. And we just learned yesterday that the AT&T building in Dallas has a museum – in their lobby that's interactive, and then the corporate offices are around it. There are just unlimited numbers of ways that we can get people back on Canal Street, even the big ones. We want all sizes, and that's the way you make a successful street.
You mentioned tax credits, and I'm fiscally conservative, as are most people, but that's going to have to be a part of this, is it not?
Yes.
Because it's a competitive atmosphere with the rest of the country.
Right, but there are ways to package For example, the restoration, the $10 million, $12 million restoration of the Joy Theater was put together entirely by five or six major companies putting in. That's how they invest in oil wells. That's how they invest in movies. You know, so no one takes one big hit.
Right.
They have lots of ways to put the packages together, and we have really good experts that are doing that thinking right now for us.
Biggest hindrance, if you had to name one or two, would be what?
Well, here's what I'm going to say.
Challenges. Let me call it a challenge.
This is what I'm going to say. Every time someone, through my whole life, I'm incurably optimistic. And when someone asked me, I came down here and people said, look, we want you to be president of this group, this women's organization, because they all fight all the time. And I went in and I said, I'll be your president under this circumstance. No mean girls allowed, no fussing, no fighting, no arguing. I've been the president 12 years. They don't want to have another election because we're all diverse, but mm-hmm. we all love each other and get along. Now, this project is going to require all of the major stakeholders, the key political people, the key business people, and the public to all be in favor and all support this. It's a challenge, but it's one I know how to do. I was able to, when I took that $83 million bill to the legislature, it went through four different committees, two natural resources and two finance committees, and the lower house and the Senate, I had not one single no vote. So I know how to bring the public together, but we all have to be positive and work together.
Amen. Tell me the website again real quick.
CelebrateCanal.com.
Thank you. A pleasure as always. God bless you and all the work you're doing. Okay.
Thank you, Tommy.
We'll talk to you again soon. 9:54, taking a break. We'll find out what Newell's got for us when we return on WWL.
You know how you always want to know about everyone else's money? On the podcast, What We Spend, guests will, for 1 week, tell us everything they spend their money on.
My son slammed $6 worth of blueberries in 5 minutes.
And everything that makes them feel.
I want to own a house. I want to have a child. But this morning, I really wanted a coffee.
Because at the end of the day, money is always about more than your balance. Listen to and follow What We Spend, an Odyssey original podcast. Available now wherever you get your podcasts.